these concrete seas. Now she headed east down the boulevard.
Hello, welcome to episode 6 of Teacher People, the podcast that helps you know your teachers as people. I am very excited to bring to the studio today a special guest, CHS school psychologist and co-teacher in Independence Hall, Ms. Sandra Dunn. Ms. Dunn, welcome to Teacher People.
I am thrilled to be here, Mr. Zania.
We are really excited to have you, and I know that in contrast to many of the guests I've had on the podcast so far, I think that probably the majority of Chelsea High School students don't actually get to see you on a daily basis.
I am a best kept secret.
Yes. So for students who maybe either don't know you as well or don't know your role in the building, would you be willing to tell us just right off of the bat, what is your role at Chelsea High School?
My role varies a lot from year to year, actually, depending on student needs, but The long and the short of it is I am still a school psychologist. You might know Ms. Kent, and I had her job way before she did. But there are certain student needs that are just better met more individually and not maybe in some traditional classes, or students who can't do traditional classes all day long. So I try to step in and fill in the gaps if kids need extra help in math, or they might need me to teach a reading class that starts and gives a little background so they could move into a general ed reading class. But I get to teach fun stuff. That's the part most people don't know, like photography explorations and art explorations. And those are geared to give students with special needs a background to then either that could be all they do, or a background to move in then to a photography class with more background knowledge than they had.
So you just described a number of different things that sound like a lot of fun.
Yes, there is fun.
Do you have a favorite either activity, whether in Independence Hall or with the other students you work with, that you look forward to every year or is a highlight for you, or maybe an element of those jobs that you would say stands out as just something special?
I do have several, actually. So let's pick one. We have a long-standing relationship with the University Musical Society, and that's based out of University of Michigan, and they bring in truly world-class performers in all the arts, from music, drama, dancing. And in the day, for some of those performers, about six times a year, they offer reduced price tickets for their student education outreach. And so we try to gather up all the kids that we work with a time or two a year. We used to go more frequently, but times are a little bit changing. But at least a couple times a year to remind ourselves we all one big Independence Hall family. And we all dress up and we go out to a show and then have lunch out. And we have seen, you know, Wynton Marsalis. We've seen some Brazilian dancers. Just some, like, amazing performances. So I think that would be a highlight for me because, A, we're all together. You take a field trip during the school day. That's just a different way of being together. And then we see something amazing that we can then talk about together.
So that sounds fun purely from the adult perspective.
Oh.
How do your students respond to that? What do they take away?
They probably take away the lunch piece. You know, you're eating lunch at Culver's on a school day. That's pretty fun. No, I really do think they recognize, especially the jazz and the dance, they seem to really be able to take away from that. And the other part for me is, like, Chelsea's a pretty all-white community. And so most of the performances we see are highlighting another culture or African-American dancers in our own country. And I just feel like that's probably one of the best things we do is to, like, put these brilliant, genius performers in their field who are of color in front of our students to really see that. That's probably one of the highlights of that trip, even for them, I think, because when we have the few students of color we do have when they are on our trips, I just think that feels like a point of connect. And then for our white students, I think it just maybe stretches them a little bit.
So going back a little bit in time, how did you decide that you wanted to be a school psychologist, or how did you make your way into education?
The long and the short, the true answer, which is not going to sound very mature, but you know, when you're in college, you're not very mature. I love to learn. Let's just start there. I continue to take classes. I love to learn. So I changed majors in college at West Virginia University, probably three or four times, wide-ranging things, horticulture, criminal justice. I ended up in psychology, and my whole focus in college was I was on the rowing team for high school and college, so I was an 8-year rower. I just wanted to keep rowing. And so I thought I should get connected to school so that I could coach. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, how shallow is that, really? Mm-hmm. And then I thought psychologists, schools, school psychologists, boom, there it was.
Oh, interesting.
But unfortunately, that led to 7 long years of grad school. I didn't really calculate that very well. Uh-huh. But I like to learn, so it was okay.
That was part of the maturing
process. Yes.
Have you ever thought about bringing your rowing to Chelsea High School, starting a Chelsea rowing team? Maybe right down there on the Huron River? I don't know. Where would we row? Maybe
we would have to.
Pierce Lake?
Pierce Lake? There is an adapted rowing program in Ann Arbor, and if my life wasn't quite as busy as it was, I would reinvest in that. And that might be my whenever I decide to retire thing that I do. And that would be for rowers that struggle with physical challenges. Because that really was a really highlight of my high school and college years.
Okay. Well, I know that, as is the case with all teachers, sometimes days at Chelsea High School get really stressful, and I know that that's no different for you. I'm curious, after a long day or a day when something just has really taken a lot of your energy in the classroom, how do you go home and relax? What do you do to let off a little steam?
I live on a little farm, and I have a couple horses, and so my time in the barn, cleaning stalls or feeding everybody, that's probably the biggest chill, you know. It's just, they're big beasts. Here's a fun fact for you. We're always into fun facts. Except for my years in college and my first 2 years of grad school, I have never lived without a horse living with me. And I got my first pony when I was 2, and I have never in my life, except when I was at college and you couldn't keep a horse. And so they are very grounding to me. Like, you know, it doesn't matter what happens during the day, I'm going to have to go home and feed them and, clean up after them. So that's probably my biggest thing. And then watching college basketball. Mm-hmm. I love this season of the year. What else might I do? I have 4 dogs, so we do a lot of walks. I have 25 acres I live on, so we do a lot of walks. Just being outside. We can talk later about the Daylily Farm. That's its whole other thing.
Okay.
So being outside, I guess, would be the short answer to your question.
That sounds
get outside.
Really nice. I was not a big pet person growing up just because my siblings had allergies, so I was really limited on what I could have. So I don't know if this is a hard question for you to answer, but do you have a favorite horse from all those that you described over the years?
That is a tough question. I have 2 that I've raised from babies, so those have to stay as favorites, but my favorite would be the classic Palomino, the golden-colored horse with the white mane and tail. But what makes him special to me, fun fact number 2, Mr. Zania, Nevada was his name, and I once did a trail ride that started on Lake Huron, clear across the state of Michigan, ended up in Lake Michigan. That was the end of the trail ride. It took us 2 weeks. And so you can't be out on a trail for 2 weeks with a horse without really, like, that's fundamentally different than shorter rides you do with all of your other horses. Mm-hmm. And so that, I would say he has to be my favorite because that experience was one of my favorite.
Huh, that does sound really, really unique. Maybe something a lot of our students only get to experience on video games, like Red Dead Redemption or something like that. So interesting. Are you worried that your horses, like, was that hard to choose one over the other? Are you worried that they'll know?
I'm thinking they will, because he's no longer alive, and the 2 at home are probably clearly going to tell that I've betrayed them, the way dogs do when you visit with another dog and they smell you immediately.
Okay.
And we didn't mention my 11 cats or 20 fish in a pond behind my house. So it's a busy household.
It sounds like it. Well, it's great to hear a little bit about your role at Chelsea High School. I'm curious a little bit about prior to your time in Chelsea, where you came from. You mentioned that a little bit about your schooling and your background, but where did you grow up and what were you like when you were a high school student?
Oh, that's a tough one. I grew up in West Virginia. That wasn't the tough part. On a little farm that's a lot like, and I know Chelsea High School students, you may not remember this, but like Walton's Mountain, where everyone on the mountain was related. We had a lot of acres, many of which were sold off during the Depression, but still at this moment right now, my mom lives on one chunk of the farm. Her sister has another chunk of the farm. Her brother has another chunk of the farm. And several of my cousins have built houses on the farm. You have to go up the hill 1 mile in one direction or a half mile up in the other. And once you get to the top, it's all my family. So that was just an ideal way to grow up. I think of it now. Sometimes I would get on my horse. This was before cell phones, of course. I would get on my horse and ride over to the neighbor's farm. She was like a probably 80-year-old woman that was like my role model because she lived by herself on a farm. And I would be gone literally all day on my horse no way for my mother to contact me, right? Mm. And I once said to her recently, like, Mom, did you ever worry, like, when I was gone all day? Mm-hmm. And she said, only the one time the horse came home without you. Because I always rode bareback, and I had gotten off, and I would use a tree or something to climb up on, and the horse got away before I got on and made its way home, and I had to walk.
So was a lot of your childhood like that, just free time to explore and open range? And...
Yes, mm-hmm. absolutely, with a lot of cousins. I'm the oldest of 21 cousins, and as I said, most of the family still lives on that, so it was... Mm-hmm. It was really a lovely way to grow up. We were the only people in our area that had machinery to bale hay. And so most of my summers were spent either in hay fields, throwing hay up on a truck and stacking it, or on a trailer and stacking it. And then we would travel from neighbor farm to neighbor farm putting up hay. So it was hot and sweaty, but you knew you were getting food in for the cows mm-hmm. and the horses for the summer, mm-hmm. winter, sorry. So it was a good outdoor life.
Did you ever have an experience that made you worried, like a wildlife encounter or a time that maybe you got lost or you were hurt in your wildlife experiences?
I did have one time that still haunts me a little bit. There, in West Virginia, because of the mining that happened there, there are lots of human-made lakes down, and it's very hilly, and there are lots of human-made lakes, and my cousin, 5 years younger than I, and her sister, who was again then 5 years younger, were off swimming in one of these really deep, secluded lakes, no adult around. And again, I'm like, oh my goodness, I grew up like this. But the younger of my cousins, Kelly, got a little freaked out in the water and started to panic. And so I had to kind of drag her back to shore. And if you've ever been a lifeguard, which I am not, you know that as someone panics more, they're harder to help. And I think about that, like realistically, we were in very deep water and we're lucky to make it back. Mm.
That's really interesting to hear you say these stories. It sounds very adventurous and yes. exciting and maybe never a dull day in your household. And it seems like it's really hard to raise young people that way nowadays, that parents might be criticized for doing something like that, or we have these phrases about there being helicopter parents mm-hmm. or parents that want to basically get rid of any sort of threat or obstacle for their young people. Do you feel like could we still justify raising young people the way that you were raised? Do you think that we're missing out on something nowadays by taking that experience away from them?
That's such a grand question. Because it is different. I'm sure that there were people that we should have been worried about for my safety or my brother's safety or my cousin's safety in those days, but we never thought about that. I think partly because we also knew all of the neighbors, maybe that made a difference. And our neighbors were, 5 miles away. Because I don't know that I would be comfortable now, like with that same kind of mm-hmm. just absolute freedom. That's a great question. But what we learned was self-sufficiency and, I am still to this day, I never have an experience of being bored. There's always mm-hmm. something that I'd love to get out and do. And so I think a lot of that came from that upbringing where the world is a grand adventure. Mm-hmm. So how could you carry that out in this current time? That's a fabulous question, Mr. Zania. Mm.
Maybe you could develop an elective class.
Could extend adventuring.
Yes, maybe extend Mr. Polly's wilderness survival class from a few years ago. Well, moving forward into the podcast, for those who haven't heard Teacher People before, we have just a basic structure that allows us to talk about a few different things. These are just based off of the warm-ups that I do with my classes mm-hmm. in school as well. So over the course of the podcast here, we'll talk about Monday music, a song that you're interested in for some reason, a Tuesday trailer for a movie or TV show or project that you'd like to share with others, a Wednesday world, which is basically a current event that's caught your attention and something that maybe you have some insight to share. Related to that. A throwback Thursday, a story from your past or something that we could go back in time to discuss, and a Friday question of the day, just an open-ended question to get us thinking a little bit more deeply. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Dunn, and she's going to offer her Monday music.
This was probably the hardest preparation, Mr. Zania, to pick a song. I have been so lucky to live among folk singers my whole life. This will date me, but in my high school days, my friends and I would sit around a literal campfire with our guitars and play John Denver and Dan Fogelberg songs. And then as I moved at different phases of my life, I seem to have always landed with a folk band near me or part of my life. In grad school in Bucknell, I worked at a jazz bar for 2 years to put myself through grad school and became friends with like an amazing jazz and folk band there. And then here in Michigan, I've had a band called Second Opinion, which is now disbanded, but love them. So I've always had these really friendships with folk singers and then singers that I was just enamored with, Cheryl Wheeler or Girly Man is a group that's just now disbanded but lovely. So this is Susan Werner, one of my long-term musical crushes, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. And if this was not a school podcast, I might have picked one of her more political or more spiritual or satirical songs, but I tried to pick one that I thought would reflect a message that I think I really connect with.
Great.
This is called May I Suggest.
May I Suggest. And just as a quick teaser before we listen, I know I'm notorious for not listening to lyrics of songs and not even knowing what they're about. What would you say is the message behind the song that you like so much?
I love this because, and I love its May I Suggest. It's not like I'm telling you what to think. I love that phrasing, May I Suggest. And the next line is, this is the best time of your life. And I think for me, it's about outlook. Like we are all facing challenges and some more so than others, but this idea that we could maybe step back and if we ask ourselves in this moment in time right now, maybe for right now, this is the best time of my life and I'm just not seeing it. So there's just lots of examples she uses. And I just love this idea that maybe we should put a pause on from like political rhetoric or critiquing or negative messages and just maybe reflect that at this moment, maybe my life is really pretty good.
Okay. With that as our setup, this is Susan Werner, May I Suggest.
May I suggest, to you, may I suggest this is the best part of your life. May I suggest this time is blessed for you. This time is blessed and shining almost blinding bright. Just turn your head and you'll begin to see the thousand reasons that were just beyond your sight. The reasons why I suggest to you, why I suggest this is the best part of your life. There is a world that's been addressed to you, addressed to you, intended only for your eyes. A secret world, like a treasure chest to you, of private scenes and brilliant dreams that mesmerize. A lover's trusting smile, a tiny baby's hands, the million stars that fill the turning sky at night. Oh, I suggest to you, oh, I suggest this is the best part of your life. There is a that's been expressed in you, the hope of seven generations, maybe more. And this is the faith that they invest in you. It's that you'll do one better than was done before. Inside you know, inside you understand, inside you know what's yours to finally set right. And I suggest to you, and I suggest this is the best part of your life. This is a song, comes from the west to you, comes from the west, comes from the slowly setting sun. With a request of you, to see how very short the endless days will run. And when they're gone, and when the dark descends, Oh, we'd give anything for one more hour of light. And I suggest this is the best part of your life.
All right, and that was Susan Warner with May I Suggest, and just a really lovely song and a lot of aspects of that that I like. One of the things that struck me hearing that for the first time just now is how church-like that is, with the chord changes and the way that it's presented. It just felt very almost spiritual mm-hmm. to me. So that was really, really nicely done. Maybe we could talk a little bit more about her music in general and this song specifically. What was your first encounter with Susan Warner? How did you come across her music?
At the Ark in Ann Arbor. I had gone there to see, at the 40th anniversary of the Ark, and students, if you haven't been there, it's just, there's nothing like live music. And the Ark has a long tradition of almost nightly live music. And I went because another performer I loved, Dar Williams, was there as part of the 40-year celebration. And I think I knew two of the four performers for the celebration. And Susan Warner was just there as the fourth. And I was just smitten from the beginning. She's so immensely talented. Each of her albums, she just gets an idea and runs with it. And you mentioned the spiritual. She did a whole album called The Gospel Truth, where she was sorting out some of her own past and conflicts with religion and her spirituality. But then she went to Cuba and did an American in Havana album. She took some class. She's just done so many types of music. She gets on something and just wants to learn about it. And so I just love her talent and her, I don't know, she connects. I just connect with some of her lyrics, I guess. She's not corn that A.T. brought. I get that. I really get that. I listened to that podcast, A.T.
Have you seen her then outside of the Ark other times?
I have probably seen her 20 times over the last 10 years.
Okay.
In little venues, I went to a library in Dearborn where she played for 30 people. They must have booked her before she got more popular. I've seen her in a lot of venues. We're at the point, just as an aside, she has a nephew who has Asperger's syndrome, which is a form of autism. And I don't even know how, after a concert, I ended up talking with her about this. That's the joy of these small venues. And so many times over the years, we've just talked questions she's had about her nephew's schooling. And I'll be in the audience, and all of a sudden she'll shout out, "There's Sandra, the special ed teacher," as I'm sitting there. So that's kind of a fun connection. So I guess I just really follow her to a lot of venues to see what she's going to come up with next.
So let's talk about that song in particular then, the May I Suggest. And hearing that, it sounds like it's a song about perspective and maybe perspective that others from the outside can grant to you when we get stuck in our own way of thinking, our own way of seeing things. And through that song, she talks a lot about these miracles that really are right in front of our eyes, but we don't always necessarily see without the guidance of a friend or someone's help. I'm curious for you, when you think back over your life experiences, do you think you could ever identify a moment that the message of that song maybe came true, that you had an aha moment, you had a sudden realization of how thankful you were for something or how wonderful something was? Or maybe if there's not one that comes to mind, is there like a most recent example of a time that just you needed that nudge to get the right perspective, and once you got it, it was very, very enjoyable?
No, I can think of a couple things that of recent, because there's so many times where I'm just so grateful for the people that are around me that do nudging is a great way, like think about that differently. But I really am in the phase of my career where I think, should I retire, should I continue? And I have this chart at home, and at the end of the day I'll go home and that's one day for the retire side of the chart. Nope, that's a day for a continue side of the chart. And two of those happened just after winter break here at Chelsea High School, when, you know, we're off on break. I think all of us feel the same way. Like, as much as I love my job, it's like, oh, we have to go back, you know, because your schedule changes, your choices you get to make change. And so I was coming back from winter break, probably with that little bit of dread that all of us have as we return. And I'm still thinking, like, if I feel that way, why am I returning? I could, like, make my own choices all the time if I retired. And on our first day back, one of the students I work with could not wait to show me on her phone that she had gone to Florida and she had videotaped 1 minute of live flamingos because she know I love flamingos. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking, here is a kid on her vacation over winter break, and her thought when she sees them is, I can't wait to tape this and show my teacher. Like, mm-hmm. isn't that lovely? Like, I don't know. That was one of those moments for me where you feel like these relationships we make, they give back so much to you. And then also, a kid came right back from winter break. I tend to love antique old brooches. That's a word for pins. And one of my students notices what brooch I have on every day and uses the word brooch, which I personally think for a 15-year-old is an incredible vocabulary word because most of us would say pins. And she told me of one in an antique store that she really wished she could have bought for me, but she was afraid I might have had it. But she told me exactly where it was in the antique store. Mm-hmm. And if I wanted to go and get it, I should probably check it out soon before someone else got it. And again, it's this idea that we see each other every day, and she comments on whichever brooches I like, but that she's out in her everyday life. And her first thought is, I got to tell Miss Dunn that there's this brooch she's probably going to like. She should pick it up. Mm-hmm. So those little moments are the refreshers that if I start to think, like, why am I doing this? I come back to, I always say it's the capital R relationship and the little R rule and routines. Mm-hmm. And in my world, the capital R relationship is like how I teach, and the small R rules and routines, those will follow. But if they grow out of a relationship, you sort of develop the rules and routines together. Mm-hmm. But you can only develop the relationship, the capital R, if you're both working at it. And when my students are working at it and they let me know that, that's just one of those nudges.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to move into the second segment of the podcast here, which is the Tuesday trailer. And again, this is just Ms. Dunn's opportunity to share about a movie, TV show, or project that you're interested in. So I'll turn it over to you.
And my first thought was to try to negotiate with my teacher here, Mr. Zania, to not have this question. In my
you
world...
You sound like one of my students with an essay assignment or something.
Yes,
like that.
Exactly. I don't like the question, but I'd like to answer this question. Mr. Zania, can we talk about books? Mm-hmm. So really, that was my first impulse. I was trying to think about this. This will be something. The last movie I probably saw was Zootopia with my nieces. So that's a long time ago. But then I remembered this other movie. In my world, it is very busy. I also coach Special Olympic sports through all seasons and have the farm. And so it's really busy. And there will be periods that I realize my TV has not been turned on for 2 or 3 weeks at a time, except during basketball or The Voice and a little HGTV. But there are periods where literally weeks I don't watch TV, I don't go to movies. So I wanted to redirect to books because my phone, if I scrolled it, is just every time I hear a book, I'm writing it down. I'm sure there's an app for this, but I just text myself. Mm-hmm. But then I remembered this movie, The Mule, and I picked it for a couple reasons. It is based on real life events that took place at Baker Road here on 94. So I thought for those of us at Chelsea, some of you may know where I'm going with this story. And it's about the flower, the daylily, which is the flower that I grow on my farm. And so I did remember that I had gone to see this movie as soon as it came out. It's called The Mule. This trailer, after I sent it to Mr. Zania, is a little tough because you really need to be watching it. So let me tell you what's going on. There's a very older gentleman played by Clint Eastwood. And in the movie, I think his name's Earl Stone. But he's actually based on a real-life daylily farmer that I have met and have been to daylily conferences with. And in the movie, there are scenes from daylily conferences. I was just at one in Indianapolis yesterday, or the weekend, and I just got back yesterday. So it's based on the life of Leo Sharp. And having met Leo Sharp, I still grow flowers that he created. When you produce daylilies, you take the pollen from one and you fertilize the other and you create new flowers. I have a lot of Leo Sharp's flowers. And then it rocked our daylily world when we find out that he's actually been a drug runner for a very big Mexican cartel at the age of 85 to 89 or something. For those of us who knew him, this was staggering news. I mean, because he was just not a minor league player. He was a major league drug runner. And the ultimate arrest of him took place on 94 outside the Baker Road exit. So for these reasons, mm-hmm. I present this movie and this trailer. But you have to know that in the trailer, there's a lot of action you can't see, such as him trying to hide the drugs in his truck when a police officer comes to him. And I know the movie has been, Hollywood remade a bit, but the facts of the story are still true. They said it in Chicago. We would now know he was running them to Detroit. So when you can't see something going on in the trailer, it's often him interacting with members of a drug cartel, either to get cocaine from them or to deliver it where he's delivering, which is not really high school appropriate material. So don't do that at home.
Nor things I anticipated we'd discuss here on the podcast today, but you know, never a dull day with Miss Dunn. Here is the trailer for The Mule.
Need help, sir?
Oh, officer, hi.
You need help?
No, I'm fine, thank you.
What do you got there?
Pecans. I'm delivering pecans to my niece.
Pecans.
She makes the worst pecan pie you've ever tasted. I feel sorry for her husband, but, and I feel sorry for the pecans, too. Family's the most important thing. Don't do what I did. I put work in front of family. I thought it was more important to be somebody out there than the damn failure I was in my own home. I was a terrible father. Terrible husband. My chance. I didn't deserve forgiveness. This is the last one. So help me God. This is the last one.
All right, we are back, and that was the trailer for the movie The Mule, and yeah, very tense and stressful trailer there to watch all of that going on. I'm curious, for a movie like this, what would you say is the value of a movie like The Mule? It's not just pure entertainment. It's not just action there. It seems like there's more substance to that. One thing that struck me watching that trailer is that you have this guy who seems like, at his core, he's a decent guy, mm-hmm. not a bad guy. Maybe sometimes we assume that drug runners or people involved with things like that instantly are bad people, or they have some sort of mark on their soul or something like that. Do you think, is that what this movie was getting at, to force us to look more deeply mm-hmm. at people or see the complexities in people mm-hmm. that maybe on the surface might seem like they have some problems or are flawed?
Mm-hmm. I think he is a complex character, and I say this knowing, like, the man whom this character was based on. He, in any field, you can rise to the top. He was at the top of his game in the world of daylilies. You may ask, like, what is that? But there is a world out there of daylily creators and sellers and buyers, and he was at the top of his game, ran his own nursery, but it was never enough for him. And when he says in the trailer about choices he made to ignore his family or not be the dad he wished he was or not be the husband he wished he was pursuing that career to the detriment of his relationships with his own family. That could be any profession, right? Someone could be so driven to be the best in their profession that they ignore the relationships right around them. And I think that was partly what happened. But yet he didn't financially get where he wanted to go from that. And I think that was the entry into the world of drug running. He was an unlikely drug carrier, right? He started in his 80s. And how that mistake snowballed itself. And then he got in and then he couldn't get out. And you see times in the movie when he appeared to want to separate himself, but yet he knew things, so they weren't going to let him. And he was a very effective runner for them because he didn't get picked up. He's driving back and forth from Detroit to Mexico. It's just sort of a series of decisions and how they could snowball. But yet, as you said, at his core, that does that make him a bad person or just someone that wasn't reflective enough to realize where he was going mm-hmm. with all this?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hear you talk about these people with this almost obsessive drive to be the best at their game or whatever mm-hmm. it is that they do. And I think you're right that you look at almost anything, a basketball player mm-hmm. or a writer or a mountain climber or any, you know, all of the above, they all have this maybe line that they are willing to cross mm-hmm. and sacrifice certain things so that they can achieve that glory or fame or mm-hmm. status associated with that. So that's interesting to think about how widespread that is. Are you typically a fan of movies like this? Would you say this is your genre, or would you say your connection to this is more so the personal connection with the character or the daylilies aspect of it? Is that what draws you to The Mule?
I hope in my retirement I will watch movies, but I always say to my friends when they start the sentence with, "Have you seen the movie?" I just say no. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't happen. And so I don't know that I have a style of movie, although I have a style of book, which is biography or historical fiction. So that bleeds over to movies, too. Mm-hmm. I think for me, truly, it was that it rocked our daylily community. And there were some really beautiful scenes of daylilies mm-hmm. in here.
So can you tell us a little bit more? You've mentioned daylilies a few times in the podcast, and I know this is a major passion of yours, mm-hmm. but what does your work with daylilies look like now on a day-to-day basis, or are you running your own company? Mm-hmm. How does your work with daylilies look?
I have a little farm, as I said, and daylilies, if you don't know what that flower is, if you drive along the roads in Michigan in June, late June, July, you'll see those orange flowers on the side of the road. That would be the most common reference for what a daylily is. And it would be really boring to just sell lots of those. So over the years, people have cross-pollinated lots of those, which are not native to Michigan, even though we see them all around. They're native to Asia, Japan. In Korea, countries like that. I know Asia's a continent, don't get me wrong. But we've brought them over here. We won't talk about that right now. People have cross-hybridized them to make new colors. So at our farm, we have 2,200 different varieties.
Wow.
Everything from little 2-inch pinks and purples to flowers where the plant itself is 10 to 12 inches, which is enormously big, dark purples. And so at our farm, people walk up and down the rows of daylilies and they put a flag, a little marker flag, in front of the ones that they want to take home with them. And then I hire a lot of teenagers in the summer, note that, Chelsea people, three or four people going to school here right now work at the daylily farm, and lots of my nieces and nephews. And so then we would go and dig them for them and send them home. And they're an easy plant to transplant. So even in the hot of summer, they can take them home and they will grow. And it's just really getting your hands in dirt, just being that in touch. I do some of the cross-pollinization to create new varieties of my own, but having an open retail business where people come to your house keeps me super busy in the summer. I'm only open 3 days a week because, you know, I do want to have some fun in the summer. But it's just a lovely world with, I have retired people working with me. I have a lot of teenagers. I love the energy of teenagers, if you haven't picked that up. Mm-hmm. And so to have teenagers around in the summer and work here at school, and we really are like a retail place that people buy daylilies.
It sounds almost like an entirely second job that you have on top of what you do here at Chelsea High School. So
that is true.
No doubt that you are very busy. What would you say is the hardest part of running a daylily farm?
Well, there's the physical labor, but I love that. Having that many people at my own house, I thought would have been the hardest part. But again, I just meet such lovely people. Gardeners are really good souls, I think. So we've really rarely had any difficulty with anyone who has come to the house. The hardest part is that I have to keep the inside house clean because I can't fathom the idea of a porta-john, but people need a bathroom, so they go to my own house. And I have to keep my inside house clean. That's the hardest part, quite honestly, mm-hmm. of the daylily farm. There's nothing about the outdoor work We have staff meetings with all the teenagers and talk about what's going well. They know we have three goals of Along the Fence Daylilies, and I'll put them on the spot and say, you know, one of the goals of Along the Fence is that people have a respite from their busy lives when they're out here. John, how have you contributed to that today? Mm-hmm. And the first couple of times, they're like, what? And then they get used to, you know, she's going to ask us, how are we contributing mm-hmm. to this organization right now? Mm-hmm. So we just have some lovely discussions, meet some lovely people. Mm-hmm. But really having to keep, when I want to be outside all summer long, having to keep the bathroom and the house clean for people to use, that's really mm-hmm. single mom. You bet you didn't think we'd talk about that today
did you? I guess if that's the hardest part, then that's not too bad.
No, it's not too bad.
An issue to be working through. So just to bring us full circle back to where we started in the trailer, the first scene is him being stopped by a police officer, and there's this incriminating evidence in his trunk that he's trying to cover up.
I'm curious. And you hear the dogs.
Yeah, it sounds like not a nice situation to be in. Do you have anything in your car right now that you would not necessarily get in trouble for, but would be embarrassed if people knew
yes.
Is there anything you're keeping from us?
I live in my car. You would probably find a lot of potato chip bags. Mm. Not chocolate, because I gave that up for Lent, but normally you would. You would, my car, that could be its own short story. Mm-hmm. A day in Sandra's car. Can I tell you one story? One of my students, Ella, I love her, and sometimes on the weekends we're at basketball tournaments together for Special Olympics, and she just has a tendency to look around my car in true disgust, like, how could I live like this with, you know, wrappers from things I've eaten. So she will just clean around in my car, and then after she got everything in the car itself cleaned, she started in on my purse, which took me aback for a minute, but she starts pulling stuff up and looking at me and saying, really? You need this, really? And then just pitching it in the garbage can right in my own car. She was just like, I don't know. I just found that so amusing that she felt the need to clean my car a little bit. So that would probably be my embarrassing secret. What a slob I can be.
Maybe she just needs to change the approach a little bit and try. May I suggest?
I suggest we get rid of all of this.
I think that might be the way going forward.
And you will find, one other thing in my car, you will find Ziploc bags of dog and cat food under the seats, because living in the country, inevitably I run across stray dogs and stray cats. Mm-hmm. And to lure, if they're not around anyone, or if I need to see if they have a collar, I mean, we're talking, this happens multiple times in a year, I lure them with dog and cat food. So that would, you might wonder why I carry dog and cat food under my car seat. That would be why.
Okay.
Well. And one time on the way to Chelsea High School, in the morning, I literally found a horse along the side of the road. Hmm. Now, who could say that? So of course I stop, it's 6:50 in the morning, because I live a ways from Chelsea. And I'm like, I cannot leave this horse grazing along the side of the road. So I got out. I did not have horse grain in my car, but I had a lead rope, and the horse let me come right up to him, and I caught him, but then I didn't know like what to do with him. So I just left my car and started walking backwards for a half a mile till I came to the next farm. And it was by now 7:10 in the morning or whatever. I called school to say, I'm going to be late. I found a horse. The secretaries here are wonderful with my crazy excuses. And, knocked on a door, no one answered, but they had other horses, so I assumed it was theirs. And I know if it was my horse that had gotten out, I would want it to be safe. So I finally had to beep the horn of their car, and someone in a nightgown came out and staggered out and said, yep, it's my horse. And I could pass the horse. That had a happy ending.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good. Well, I don't know that that's one of the absence excuses, reasons on the slip.
Found a horse on the way to work.
But I think the story makes for an interesting tale to tell down the road. Well, we're going to move into our Wednesday world, which is just a quick discussion on a current event or a topic of interest to the guest. And so I will turn it over to Miss Dunn, and she can tell you a little bit about her topic for Wednesday world.
This was another struggle, because there's so much going on in the world right now. But one thing really struck me, I think it was last week. I'm an NPR junkie and National Public Radio, and I had listened to a story that, whether or not you're pro or against fracking is relatively irrelevant to this story. So I just want to say that up front, that in order to bring some of the natural gas from the places in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, that the pipeline is going to go under a section of the Appalachian Trail. Mm-hmm. And it's going to disrupt the view of the Appalachian Trail for about 100 miles. And growing up in, you know, West Virginia amidst the mountains, I've not hiked any significant lengths of the Appalachian Trail, but I've certainly been on the Appalachian Trail. And it just got me to think of the bigger current event of all the ways our national parks right now are what I would consider under attack. And, you know, for 102 years now, our national park system has been a gem. Like Woodrow Wilson had the brilliance to say, we should reserve some land for American people to just enjoy. And the Appalachian Trail story was just one more. We have, like, right now, the Oregon Pipe cactuses are being destroyed in one of our national parks. And in Utah, the Bear's Ears, 2 million acres open to off-road vehicles and habitat destruction, and some of our current energy policies being seen as more valuable than public land. So I guess that's what I throw out here for us to discuss, mm-hmm. Mr. Zania, the protection of public lands for public use. Mm-hmm. And are we in a time that that is really coming to be not the priority? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I heard a little bit about this story last week as well. It sounded like the Supreme Court was hearing this case, and they were debating what constitutes a trail. Is it just the surface of the ground, or is it the soil underneath the trail? Does that still count? Some really interesting philosophical debates going on there. And yeah, I've heard about some of these same kinds of things that you bring up. So for someone who says, like you brought up the cactuses in Texas that are being essentially removed to build a wall, mm-hmm. or you talked about the barriers in, I think, Utah, mm-hmm. out west, where they're trying to open up areas that could be explored perhaps for natural resources, mm-hmm. or energy resources, oil, natural gas, things like that.
We didn't even talk about Alaska.
The Arctic Wildlife, yep. Reserve and things like that. So for someone that makes the case that those might trump whatever we get from nature, from the, mm-hmm. national parks, that we need energy security, we need border security, mm-hmm. what would you say it is about nature or the national parks that is so valuable?
Mm-hmm. I think especially for those of us who live in Michigan, I mean, this is a beautiful state. I didn't grow up here, but I have come to really love this state flat as I feel that it is growing up in West Virginia. But with the lakes that we have and the number of people, like I think here in this high school, who do outdoor kind of things, right? I think as Michiganians or Michiganders, whichever we choose, we appreciate our nature around us. And so we have set aside areas that we can just go out and be with nature. And so this has been set up on a national scale. And why? So the question is, why should we care? Was that kind of the question?
Yeah, or what is the value in nature? Why is it a valuable thing?
Why is it a value? It restores our soul. You know, that's all I can say is it is the pulse from which we get our energy. It restores our souls, mm-hmm. In my belief, right? Even though studies have shown if you go barefoot, that's probably a plus. But mm-hmm. anyway, I don't know. I just feel, well, A, we live on this planet, right? For at least a while longer. That timeline seems to be a little bit under debate right, mm-hmm. now. But what would I say? And your question of do we need energy? Well, of course we need energy, right? So then you could take the counter argument, as we're prone in English classes to do, mm-hmm. right? Propose the counter argument and defend it. There are alternate sources for energy that wouldn't disrupt the public lands. And I think about people who, we live in busy, crazy times. And for people, a lot of people, I should have looked up the numbers, spend their family vacations in public state parks or national parks or local public parks. And to have that respite, that's a word I've used 3 times now, if you hadn't noticed, Mr. Zania, it must be important to me right now, to have that respite of going out into nature to restore, to take a break, and to think of that slowly eroding for future generations is just kind of a rough one for me to get a handle on.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, we are going to forge ahead into the fourth segment of our podcast, our Throwback Thursday, just a look back in time with Miss Dunn to something from her past, and I will let her share that with you.
I mentioned that I was a rower, and at West Virginia University, I rowed, and we made it to the national championships, which are held in Philadelphia on the Schuylkill River. And so the year after I was done in college, I was off in grad school at Bucknell in central Pennsylvania, and many of my teammates were still at West Virginia rowing, including my brother. So that's odd that a brother and sister could be in the same sport, but my brother and I were both rowers. And so I wanted to drive to Philadelphia to see the team in the year after I had graduated meet. And so a friend and I were driving down the Pennsylvania Turnpike, and it's busy. It's like three lanes of traffic. It's going really fast. And up ahead, I see that there is a boxer dog moving in and out of traffic, trying to get itself across the road. I was just so concerned for this dog that I really foolishly pulled off to the side of the road. My friend is like, "You can't stop on the turnpike." And I'm like, "Do you see the dog over there?" So we pulled off, and quite amazingly, I got my car door open, and it's as if that dog knew, like a lifeline had just landed. It made the last dash in front of a speeding car, because it's a turnpike, you're going fast. The last dash, and literally without even looking back, jumped in my back seat of my car. And I think he was so grateful to be off of, you know, there's barriers on both sides, and he had gotten himself somehow caught on this turnpike in all this traffic. He was frightened. So we closed the door. My friend and I pulled off to the next rest area, which was the safer thing to do. And I look, and he has a rabies tag, but he doesn't have a phone number tag. And so this is on a Saturday morning. A rabies tag, I called the county animal control for that county. They were not open until Monday morning of that week. He has no other identification. I think it was before people chipped dogs very much. And so my friend and I were on our way to the races. So we stopped and pulled into the nearest, I think it was probably a Kmart at that point, got a leash, got a water bowl, got some dog food, say, "We're going to take this dog on a 3-hour road trip with us." So we take the dog. I have him on a leash walking. You know, we spent the day. I watched my brother row. We did all the things we had intended to do. Meanwhile, I suddenly have this extra dog with me. So I took him back to my, and then we drive the 4 hours back to where my apartment is when I'm in grad school. So I sneaked him in because I was in a no pet apartment. Kept him for 2 days till it could be Monday morning when the rabies office would open. And I call and I get a name and I get an owner. And he turned out to be really a sweetheart of a dog. I called him Turnpike because we picked him up on the turnpike. And finally I tracked down a number of an owner. Like, maybe that took me till Tuesday to pull all that together and find an owner. And I called him and he said, I'll be right over. And I'm like, well, here's the problem. He told me he was in like 3 hours from me. He had lost the dog in a place where he was traveling, so he wasn't near his home. I was not where the dog was found. So he said, "I'll make you a deal. I'm a whitewater raft instructor in the, I can't even remember what river now, Lehigh maybe." He said, "I can't get there to get him because I'm booked every day whitewater raft tours. If you can find a way to get him here next weekend, I'll take you and your friend whitewater rafting." So we end up, I keep the dog in grad school, take him with me everywhere I go for a week. We ended up meeting up with his owner, and the joy on this dog when he saw his actual owner, he ran to him, he jumps up, he puts his paws on his chest. Clearly they had missed each other. Clearly this dog had wandered far away, and my friend Cindy and I had an absolutely amazing whitewater adventure.
Hmm. Did the dog get to go on the rafting trip?
He stayed at home, at the camp where they whitewater, and I think he was probably more securely tied than he had been before. Huh. But this is why, if I listed all the times I have ended up with a stray from some adventure, but that was the most notable because of the really precarious start to it when he's dodging in and out of traffic and I'm feeling like this could end really badly.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. That story took so many twists and turns there. That was really interesting, and obviously a happy ending is always nice.
Happy ending's good.
I guess this can sometimes be difficult to talk about, but have you ever had stories like that where you maybe took an animal in or you tried to help and it didn't have a happy ending or came back to bite you, no pun intended?
Yes. Just 4 weeks ago, I live in the country. I swear people drop off their animals knowing I will care for them. All of my four current dogs are strays and cats, and except for the one day on the way to Chelsea, no stray horses. But just four weeks ago, a corgi, if you don't know what that is, it's a shorter legged dog, and a basset hound end up in my yard. And the basset hound is so emaciated that I could see every rib, and you could see her hip bones. And if you know dogs at all, her toenails were so long, they were curled under. They were like over an inch long. So she's been on the run for some time now. So I did take both of them in. This was on a Saturday evening. And there are some Facebook posts now to find lost animals. And Ingham Animal Control, my county, was not open, but I contacted them on Monday morning. So I posted everywhere that I found these two dogs. Had anyone missed them? No one had. They took them in Monday morning took them in to get them scanned. I had to take a day off work, don't tell, to get them scanned. And they didn't have chips. They didn't have any collars. And my vet, I love him. He took good care of them. He felt that the corgi was healthy, but the basset hound really was not very healthy at all. And she did not look very healthy. So the long and the short, I'll speed this story up, is that I never found their owners. I was able to find, and that would have been six dogs for me, which would have been a lot. I would have considered it, except the basset hound was not housebroken. And so I'm at work long hours, and my dogs can come in and out of a dog door and then in and out through the garage to a pen. So they're pretty self-sufficient while I'm at work. She was not. And she was so unhealthy that I felt like she needed full-time care I couldn't give. So she is the first dog that I ever turned over to a rescue agency. She's now at Basset Rescue, and they are getting her healthy. But to me, that's not a happy ending. I kept her for a week trying to find her owners, and she was really sweet. And, you know, just it's the first dog I have ever not kept. But I know now that she is lovely with a great family and doing great and putting on weight, and she's in good vet care. I know all that intellectually. I just still feel like she ended up in my yard. I should have found a way to keep her.
It sounds like all these interactions with animals reminds me of like a Dr. Doolittle kind of figure. Or those people that would come on to night shows and bring four different animals to display. And it sounds like, oh, I've got a corgi here.
And
I've got a horse out
this.
Back. And I've got this in my pocket. Sounds like maybe another second career waiting for you there. Just before we move on to our Friday question of the day, I'm curious. You've told us a lot of stories about your animal experiences at home and outside of school. But you've been at Chelsea High School for how long now?
Since 1992.
Okay,
a
so
long
we're
time.
Getting close to 30 years here.
Yeah, not as long as Mr. Mitchell, I want to throw out there.
Can you think of any interesting animal encounters you've had at Chelsea High School?
Oh, I just had one this year, Mr. Zania. Funny, okay. I'm like a magnet for stray animals. I park over on the north side by the art. I know that the English department is lovely, but I honestly believe I live in the best neighborhood of the school. It's where the art department is, the music department, Mr. Dwayne Moss. We are down there, and I call that like our neighborhood down there. And Ms. Popovich was looking out her window, and there was a stray orange cat in the parking lot. And in the morning on the north side, students are coming into the student lot. It's very busy down there. And so this poor cat looked absolutely terrified, like trying to cross the street to get to the woods, but then he'd take a couple steps and a car would come and he would run back under the cars. And apparently Ms. Popovich had tried to catch the cat, but he was not having it. But I must have that cat karma thing, because I got out of the road, saw how scared he was, and he let me scoop him right up. And so I sort of held him because he was really trembling. And there's a lot of traffic right there. And so she got a box ready really quickly with a towel in it. And I got him into her room, and we both held him like calmly for a while. And we tried to figure like what would be our best strategy right now. We probably can't keep this cat here at Chelsea High School. So we made the decision. I quickly ran him to Lane Animal Hospital on the north end of town to have him scanned for a chip. But in the meantime, we started asking if anyone around here, because I thought he probably lived in that neighborhood over behind the woods behind the school. And in the meantime, someone knew who the cat was, so we were able to have them go to Lane Animal and pick him up. So that had a happy ending also.
Oh, good. Excellent. Except for Ms. Popovich. We have to work on our cat channeling skills there.
But she did good. She noticed him, got the box, and got him a warm blanket.
Okay. Well, we'll give her partial credit. Well, we're going to move to our final segment, our Friday question of the day. And this is always the chance for the guest to turn the tables and pose some questions to me. So I'll turn over to Ms. Dunn, and you can fire away.
I have been pondering this, Mr. Zania. There are so many, because I love chatting with you. But here's the one I'd like us to settle on. As teachers, what do you think our role is, or how should we be approaching misinformation circulation?
And this is something in an English setting in particular we deal with when doing research papers or teaching students to verify sources or understand that a source is relevant and authoritative and something that we can trust. I think it's a really difficult topic because, as I think we're all aware of, there are so many places that you can get information now, and not all of them are good, and a lot of them actually are very skewed or slanted. So that's difficult. I think just one of the basic things maybe that we can do is have dialogue about it, bring it to the table for discussion. You know, I think that maybe people assume that it's just second nature that we can sort through all of the different voices that we hear on a day-to-day basis. And that's probably not true. People need to be taught literacy, essentially, how to read sources just as you would a book or any other type of media. So that seems to be one part of it for me, is just facilitating dialogue. And then beyond that, I know that there are just some really concrete ways, like with my students, we have an acronym called CRAP that we talk about when we deal with a source that stands for, is it current? Is it relevant? Is it authoritative? Is it accurate from what we can tell? And is there a purpose behind it? Is it biased? Mm-hmm. So maybe educating students just on some basics like that can give them a toolkit when approaching sources or texts in the real world. I don't know, in your teaching experience, do you find that, do you have to do similar sorts of things to be very direct about your teaching of information or misinformation, or have you found anything helpful in your own life to help sort through those voices?
Well, it's certainly one that I am really thinking about a lot in this era of anyone being able to come across as an expert when they're not, and in a time where I feel like science is a little less valued. So I think it's one I'm working through. Certainly we do source checks when we're doing projects or papers and things, but I wonder even beyond that in our just day-to-day interactions, if there's a time for that too, or maybe to just, I will find myself caught sometimes when someone says something that I don't actually believe is factually accurate, but it's socially awkward to call them out in front of people. So I do struggle with this a bit, but I also feel like if I wait to do it privately and don't address it in that moment, then all the people who heard it have gone away with thinking that it's not that it is accurate when I don't believe it to be.
Yeah,
so it's a struggle for me currently. That's why I pose it to you, I guess.
Yeah, it's definitely very tricky because you don't want someone to feel embarrassed that they might have believed in something that wasn't true, or, you know, usually there's at least some sort of reason why they might believe that to be the case right offhand. So it is a very delicate kind of line to walk. I'm curious, do you feel like in your own practice or in your own life, is there a reason that this question came up? Is there a context or a specific sort of issue that you can think of that this connected to that really has brought it to the forefront for you?
Yes. First, I'll relate it back to a song because that's how my life goes. There's a Cheryl Wheeler song, and one of the lines is frequently wrong, but never in doubt. And I just love that line. But I think about in my own experience, I work with a lot of people with autism and study a lot about autism. And there's a pervasive view that vaccines can trigger autism. And, you know, in the world I work with, I work with a lot of people with autism. And that came from a study, an irresponsible paper, not even a study, that was published many, many, many years ago by someone that has been certainly discredited in many times. But that pervasive view, based on not science, has caused a number of people not to have their children vaccinated, which has caused an increase in a lot of diseases. And autism is so complex that we don't really understand, like, for sure where it comes from, but I'm sure that there are, and some people believe it's toxins in the environment. There's just a lot, but I think the theory of vaccines has been disproven, but yet it, if you ask people, that's probably one of the most prevalent. And so I think that's what gets me thinking about it. It might not be how we get to a broader view of misinformation, but it is one that in my work life and personal life has certainly been around for years. And I think it feels to me like there's no talking someone out of it who believes that this is true.
It seems maybe that there are people who feel like let's use government as an example, feel like the government hasn't been honest with people, or leaders have offered lies or distorted truth or something like that. And it seems like there's maybe been some taking that and broadening it to say, since one person in one context told me something that wasn't true, therefore all people in all contexts are telling me things that aren't true, so the only thing I will believe is my own word. And maybe there's need to have a little bit of nuance in there and recognize that perhaps in some contexts you can make a case that authority figures couldn't be trusted, but that doesn't mean that all authority figures, or even most authority figures or experts, are people that we should just automatically discount. Maybe there's a need to sort of sort that out a little bit more carefully.
And I think, was it with Mr. Taylor, or was it Mr. Taylor, you talked about the decline of the printed newspaper? Like, I still get a printed paper every day in my local small community, and I think there's something about that also. Just like who are our sources of news now, mm-hmm. that contributes to what people believe to be news versus what's actual fact-based news. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I really value my time. You ask other ways to de-stress. I really value that I still can come home from work right now and I will pull a newspaper out mm-hmm. of my newspaper box.
Yeah, I enjoy that too and look forward to that part of my day. Well, this was just one more reminder that as you're such a fascinating person for all the different interests you have and all the different things that you think about. And I know that you are wonderful at sharing that with our students and making the students at Chelsea High School better for that. So I appreciate your time today sharing this with our audience on the podcast and with me and for all that you do every day for the students of Chelsea High School. Thank you.
Thanks for asking me. It was an honor.
And we want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in today to Teacher People. Tune in next month for yet another guest. And as always, we want to encourage you to remember that your teachers are people too. Thank you for listening.
Said I like the way you sail your ship now. Let me be your cargo. I won't weigh you down. No, honey, I won't weigh you down.